from Santa Barbara, California. The Timeless Voyager with Bruce Stephen Holmes. Talk radio for the new age. Interviews with well-established professionals in the fields of New Age philosophy, holistic health care, energy healing, psychic phenomena, and extraterrestrial encounters. And now, Bruce Stephen Holmes, the Timeless Voyager.
Bruce Stephen Holmes, Timeless Voyager Radio. With me today, David Steinman. Diet for a Poisoned Planet is the book. It's a Ballantine book. David's been on the show once before. Welcome to the show, David.
Hi, how are you today?
All right. Diet for a Poisoned Planet. Why did you write the book?
We have a right to control our exposure to toxic chemicals, and I wanted people to have that ability to go into any supermarket and know what kind of chemicals were in their food so that they could make informed choices. It's a book that the federal government could have written if it were more consumer-oriented, but it was left to an independent writer like me to tell people what's in their foods, what kind of chemicals, pesticides, industrial chemicals.
All right, so for our listeners, the way that the book is set up, is it set up almost like a consumer guide, isn't it?
Oh, it's a very practical book, and it divides foods into red light, yellow light, and green light. Green light foods being the safest foods. Those are foods that have high nutritional qualities and very few chemicals, whether or not they're grown organically. An example, for example, of a green light food might be watermelon, pineapple, red snapper. And then there are some other foods which have much more contamination with pesticide residue. An example of a red light food might be peanut butter, which I think is one of the dirtiest foods in the supermarket. I've looked at the federal monitoring records, and I'm amazed at all the cancer-causing chemicals that are poured into that crop. So it's a very practical book. I think it's especially important for parents of children, because we tend to be very, very concerned about our children and what they're ingesting and what they're putting in their bodies. And it's very, very good to know that you can make a lot of choices so that your children don't get exposed to carcinogenic, cancer-causing chemicals, and that you feel that you're giving your child the best opportunity to grow up healthy.
All right, let's backtrack a little bit now. I guess the first question is, why should we be concerned about the chemicals? I mean, I know that probably sounds like a silly question, but I think that it's a good one to address right now.
I think it's a great question, and I'll tell you why. We often, people have the feeling that they're invulnerable, that they can't be hurt by things which are unseen. You know, I talk to people who smoke, for example, and who tell me, well, my lungs don't hurt from smoking. But statistics have a way of leveling things out over a long period of time. And science has found that people will get cancer as a result of environmental chemicals like pesticides, like industrial pollutants in our food, in our water, in our air. And they build up what I call a cancer burden on the body. That is, the more chemicals we ingest and that stay in our tissues or that damage our cells, the greater our chances of getting this disease. And this is a disease which is, to some extent, human-made. That is, we cause the disease, and therefore we can prevent the disease. So when you make a choice, for example, to buy red snapper for seafood instead of swordfish, you're making a choice, an informed choice for health, because the snapper is so pure. On the other hand, the swordfish will have two highly toxic chemicals, polychlorinated biphenyl and methylmercury. And as a result, you make a very informed choice, and it's a choice for health.
How does this happen? Why is the swordfish so pesticide-ridden and the red snapper not?
Well, so some fish live very high on the food web. They eat other fish which have accumulated these chemicals. Other fish live in areas which are polluted. So a fish like a swordfish will eat many other fish. Then you have fish from the Great Lakes which live in polluted waters, so they become very polluted. In general, your best seafood bets are those fish which were caught in deep water and are salt water. Now, the swordfish is an exception, but red snapper, orange roughy, grouper, sea bass, tuna are all examples of fish which are very safe and are deep water, salt water fish.
So shark and swordfish, which are standards out here in California, obviously are the ones we should stay away from then.
In order of preference, shark over swordfish, but shark tends to also accumulate mercury, like the swordfish, as well as some PCB and DDT. This is a very, very important issue because I worked for over 2 years with the National Academy of Sciences in Washington, D.C. as a representative of the public interest on a committee that evaluated the safety of our nation's seafood. And at every meeting, I would lobby very, very strongly for a recommendation that consumers be told what kind of contaminants are in different kinds of seafood, Maine lobster, swordfish, salmon, etc. And the industry has done very little in this regard, and there are no federal laws to require that seafood be labeled and that consumers be informed about the contaminants. So when a consumer goes into a seafood shop or in the supermarket to buy some fish, the consumer is left without knowing anything about what this fish and the toxic chemicals in the fish might do to them or for a woman who's pregnant to her developing fetus. That's why a book like Diet for a Poison Planet had to be written, because I've gone through the federal monitoring records to point up the safest fish and the least safe fish. This is information which we as consumers have a right to, but which our government isn't providing. And it's a really, it's not a good situation, because we do have a right to this information.
Now, as long as we're talking about this chemical situation, then why don't we talk just for a moment about how these chemicals, for example, the ones you've mentioned, attack our body?
That's very interesting. When a chemical like PCB or DDT or perchloroethylene enters our bloodstream, our body releases what are known as oxygen-free radicals to vanquish this toxic invader. However, these free radicals, although they help our body fight off environmental chemicals that could hurt us, in themselves are dangerous because they're unstable. And they collide with other cells looking for an electron to stabilize them. And they strip electrons from healthy cells, making these cells less stable, and they end up damaging other cells. So it's not just the chemical itself that can damage. It's the body's own defense mechanism against these chemicals, the free radicals, which also damage the body. And there's an interesting way of looking at this. Every time a cell is damaged, it becomes a little bit less efficient at repairing itself. So the damage becomes cumulative. And that's why, one of the reasons why our bodies age and eventually self-destruct is because they are damaged by this interaction of environmental chemicals, which then promotes the release of oxygen-free radicals. And one of the ways to help our bodies fight off aging is to eat very healthy foods, that is, foods that have few, if any, carcinogenic chemicals, mutagenic chemicals, chemicals that could damage the cellular structure.
You, I guess, started this whole idea in 1985 when you read a sign that appeared out by the beach in Los Angeles.
Yes. Well, the signs were warning fishermen and women not to eat fish from the Santa Monica Bay because they had toxic chemicals. Unfortunately, I had been fishing in the Santa Monica Bay for a number of years prior to the posting of these warnings. I went with a physician to people who were fishing, and we asked them if we could draw their blood for an experiment that we did and eventually published in a toxicological journal. In this experiment, we tested their blood for pollution, and we found the people with the highest pollution levels were the same people who were eating most heavily fish from the Santa Monica Bay, proving that there really is a link between the food we eat and the chemicals we build up in our bodies. I had my own blood measured and had fairly high levels of DDT and PCB for somebody at my age. I was 29, and as a result, I became very aware of my own diet and took steps to clean it up. Now, anybody can have the blood pollution levels, their own blood pollution levels measured. Diet for a Poison Planet shows people step by step how to have their pollution levels measured. And if they have particularly high levels of any one chemical like PCB or trichloroethylene, there are things which you can do to lower your burden of this chemical. And some of these chemicals, for example, that are in our drinking water, besides being carcinogenic, can also depress the central nervous system. So sometimes I've encountered cases of people who are fatigued, depressed, chronically depressed, who can't even get out of bed. And the problem is that they've been drinking polluted water. When they have their blood levels checked, they find that they have sometimes very high levels of trichloroethylene or perchloroethylene, which in effect mimic drunkenness. And when they start to clean up their bodies through their diet, through cleaning up their drinking water, through using saunas to eliminate, purge some of these chemicals, they find that their energy levels return and their clarity of mind also returns.
Now, you found out something I think that's very interesting, and of course, this is basically in the first chapter of your book. And you talk basically, or right, you really address Alzheimer's disease, and you have found some interesting links, haven't you?
Well, scientists have been looking at the link between heavy metals and the onset of Alzheimer's. You know, disease is a very, very simple yet complex process, which is imperfectly understood. We still don't understand the causes of cancer. We still don't understand very well the causes of Alzheimer's. But And my theory on it is that it's a combination of environmental stresses as well as genetic and certain release of damaging processes in the body known as excitotoxicity, which I won't get into. But one of the links is with aluminum. Now, this link is, I think it's there. It's tenuous, but it's been shown in other areas of the world that in areas where there are heavy elements, metal elements in the soil, that people end up breathing, that they often have higher incidences of brain disorders like Alzheimer's in the population. So I suggest in the book that we be a little more careful about our use of aluminum pots and pans. But since then, I've also learned that, you know, aluminum perhaps is more efficiently brought into the body through inhalation. And it's a very common element in the environment. But there does seem to be an interplay between aluminum and Alzheimer's disease. And some of our the ways that we're exposed to aluminum include our antacids, our salt, and a number of other foods, which our baking powder, for example, may have sodium aluminum phosphate in it. And as a result, we ingest a lot of aluminum, which also can... Well, aluminum is a toxic metal. That's the bottom line. So we don't want to be ingesting it, and it may have a role in Alzheimer's. And there are, it's found in many foods in a hidden form. So Diet for a Poison Planet shows people which foods do contain higher levels of aluminum so that they can make, again, informed choices should they choose to do so.
Let's come back and talk to this. Are all the chemicals that are added to our food bad for our health?
No, there are many, many chemicals which are added to food which are fairly neutral in their, fairly neutral and which are actually beneficial. You know, we don't want foods to be moldy. We don't want foods to be taste poorly because of some of the ingredients that are added to them. And so a number of chemicals which are synthetically manufactured are not bad for people. They may not be particularly good or have many pluses, but they're not bad. You know, it's not a thing where every chemical that's made by humans is bad and every chemical found in nature is good. So we can't just look at a label And if we can't spell, if we can't read the chemical easily, say, well, that must be bad. That just isn't the way it works. So, again, in an effort to educate and inform people, Diet for a Poison Planet included a very long glossary showing the effects of defining what chemicals are in food and helping people to understand so that when they read labels that they have a little more information. There's a chapter, for example, on additives in Diet for a Poison Planet. It points out that there are some additives which we should be careful about, particularly the dyes and colorings added to food because of the way that they're made. They may be carcinogenic. And on the other hand, there are a number of additives to food like citric acid, for example, or sodium benzoate, which are very innocuous chemicals and perform important functions in terms of preserving our food. So it's not where every chemical is by any means is bad just because it's synthetic.
All right, now we're always hearing from the those people who are nutritionists that we need to certainly increase the amount of fruits and vegetables that we eat. However, you are beginning to show in your book that a lot of the fruits and vegetables, which most of us have relied on as healthy foods, contain very dangerous pesticides.
Some of them do. Some of them don't. It's not the apple, for example, that's bad. It's for our health. The apple itself is great. It's the number of chemicals which are used in growing some of these items of produce which are bad. You have to eat fruits and vegetables and lots of them to maintain a healthy body. We need the vitamin C and the beta carotene to fight off other effects of pollution. So you can't stop eating fruits and vegetables just because they've been sprayed with pesticides. But one of the points I make in Diet for a Poison Planet is that with our dollars, we can make, and we already are doing it very clearly so, changes in the way our crops are grown so that they are brought to the market more healthfully. For example, when you go into a supermarket, you can look through Diet for a Poison Planet and find, well, maybe I should buy a few things that are organic that have the most pesticides, like potatoes, for example, are notorious for having carcinogens when they're grown non-organically. But organic potatoes in most supermarkets, and I'm talking about mainstream supermarkets, are quite reasonably priced, not much more, if at all, than chemically grown potatoes. And as a result, by buying those organic potatoes, you're sending a message very clearly to the supermarket to keep stocking them, and then they in turn look for more suppliers. And that has a tremendous ripple effect throughout the agricultural community.
How does a person know whether it's been organically or chemically grown?
Great question. Good question. There are a number of certifying groups throughout the United States and Canada which have member farmers, and they have very strict standards. And when you buy some organic produce, it should say, for example, certified by Oregon Tilth or Washington Tilth, or certified by the Demeter Society, or certified by the California Certified Organic Farmers. And these are seals which mean that the food was really grown organically. Now, I've looked at monitoring results from states like Minnesota, Washington, California, and several other states of organically grown foods. And I have found that over 95% of the foods which are said to be grown organically have no detectable traces of pesticide residues. It's these people who are growing organic foods, for the most part, have been doing so for many years, so their fields have far fewer historic residues of pesticides, and they've been doing it because they think it's the right thing to do for their own health, for the health of the environment, and for the consumer. So you look for a label. Just going into a natural food store doesn't guarantee that the food will be organic. In many cases, natural food stores stock the same kinds of produce that are found in mainstream supermarkets. What you have to look for is the organic label that says it was certified by a group.
Do you have red light, yellow light, and green light foods? So you tell people very quickly which ones are the most dangerous, don't you?
Again, with produce, you know, we have a right to know which produce items have heavy amounts of pesticide residue on them. For example, apples do tend to have a lot of pesticide residue. Carrots and oranges tend to have far fewer residues. So in the book, many fruits and vegetables which we love, cauliflower, broccoli, carrots, oranges, watermelon, pineapple, bananas, are given a very clean bill of health and those that tend to have more pesticide residue, like raisins or apples, are given a warning so that people will know that they can substitute organic varieties for these. And we have these choices to make, but we have to be informed, and that's the whole purpose of Diet for a Poison Planet, is to help the shopper make those informed choices.
All right, now you stirred up quite a bee's nest with the California raisin growers over. They actually launched a very heavy campaign against your book, didn't they?
The California raisin growers voted to spend over $500,000 fighting Diet for a Poison Planet. And they did this because I pointed out that raisins contained a pesticide called Dicofol, which is contaminated with DDT. And in Diet for a Poison Planet, it says very clearly, if you want to give your children dried fruit, choose things other than raisins unless they're grown organically. Dates, for example, are much, much safer for children than raisins. And the raisin growers just thought that they could buy off my publisher and me by spending enormous sums of money countering what the book was saying. But, you know, I kept waiting for them to sue me. I was hoping that they would try and take me to court, because their case was so weak that I wanted to expose them. You know, they could have spent the $500,000 on finding a way to grow their crops without so many carcinogenic and neurotoxic chemicals. But instead, they just tried to hush up the problem. It didn't work. And they've backed off since, and I do hope that they're spending more money on finding alternatives to pesticide use.
Okay, now just in all fairness, what have you heard is their basic reason for using these pesticides?
Well, farmers since the 40s have, well, actually the use of pesticides goes back to the 19th century with chemicals like Paris Green, but primarily since the 40s, farmers have been using organic chemicals to raise crops. Many of these chemicals were developed as nerve gases for use during World War I and World War II. And these chemicals seem to increase production. So they allow farmers to produce enormous monocrops, that is, huge fields with the same crop, and to use far less manual labor. Farmers thought that the chemicals were doing an effective job at killing off insects, but one thing anybody knows who's had an insect infestation is as soon as that pesticide is sprayed, a few days later, very often, the pests will reappear. They develop a resistance to the chemicals. Well, farmers, the companies that developed these chemicals like Dow, like Monsanto, Sibigaigi, etc., also financed many of the journals, agricultural journals, and so chemical farming got written up in all the journals that farmers read, and they were sort of brainwashed into believing these chemicals were the only way to grow crops in the latter part of the 20th century. As farmers are finding out now, there are a number of hidden costs to chemical farming, namely their own health. A number of studies have found that the herbicides that farmers mix and apply to crops can cause cancer, human cancer, pollute the drinking water, kill the wildlife, and other countries and other farmers in the United States have found that now they have the techniques to grow great crops without heavy chemical use, and in many cases without any chemicals, because chemical farming wasn't the only way. It's just that it was such a heavily financed campaign from the 40s on through today, and that, you know, colleges were given enormous sums of money from chemical manufacturers to endow chairs, and the people who sat in these chairs were certainly influenced by the money to do research which supported the findings of chemicals. I mean, they do play an important role. Pesticides have no doubt helped increase production, but probably not to the extent that the chemical manufacturers claim. Many farmers today have found that they can grow crops using biological controls, like things as simple as ladybugs, as lacewings and other insects, nematodes, friendly nematodes, that they can use biological controls to grow great crops. And farmers are now learning that biotechnology is a great tool in which genetic material lines, for example, the crop pests, so that there is less need for pesticides. I think that throughout the country, we're moving away from pesticides. As slowly as it seems and incremental as it seems, we are, as a nation, moving away from less dependence on pesticides into more sophisticated forms of farming that include biological controls and biotechnology.
So would you say that, the FDA is receiving your book and your information in a better light now?
You know, sometimes a book comes onto the market and causes such a storm, and then a year or two later people say, yeah, what that guy was saying was right all along. You know, it's and that's no surprise to me that that's what's happening with Diet for a Poisoned Planet. We have gone through a pesticide addiction in this country, and the book deals with that and helps people find their way through it. It also should be noted that a senior science advisor at the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, was so taken by the book that he wrote the foreword for it. So it is accepted certainly by a number of individuals within the federal bureaucracy and different agencies. I should also mention, on the other hand, that before he left office, Governor Sununu, and I have correspondence from him to other people in government, tried to launch an enormous campaign against the book. In addition to the raisin growers, Sununu instructed the United States Department of Agriculture to call a number of media outlets, warning them not to have me appear as a guest. And as conspiratorial as that sounds, I do have all the documents from the White House and the USDA that point this up.
So once again, we find that there are interest groups that obviously earn money, and people that have jobs that are going to stand in the way of our health. Real quickly, we touched for a moment on seafood. I know that a lot of listeners are going to wonder, is sushi safe then?
Oh, great question. There are many safe sushi dishes, yes. And there are some to be aware of. Diet for a Poisoned Planet has a great guide to sushi, telling readers which ones are the safest, and which to watch out for because of certain parasites that may be in sushi. But squid, for example, is very safe. Yellowtail is very safe. Most of the tuna is very safe. I would be aware, on the other hand, of Pacific salmon, which may harbor some parasites. But safe sushi is detailed, and so you can go into any sushi restaurant and find the safest dishes and not have to worry and just enjoy your eating again.
Now, what about cuts of meat? You talk a little bit about meat in your book. Are some cuts of meat safer than others?
Oh, definitely. For example, if I were packing my child's lunch, I would substitute, instead of pork and beef bologna, I would substitute turkey breast cold cuts. And I would look on the label and make sure that the brand I bought had no sodium nitrite. Nitrite can cause a number of forms of cancer, and that's a fairly well-documented cause of some forms of cancer. So that's one choice. Certainly the fattiest meats tend to have the highest pesticide residue because many of the most toxic pesticides accumulate in fatty tissues. So pork sausage, for example, may have far more pesticide residues than a leaner cut of pork. Always look for the leaner cuts. In addition, a number of beef in this country, most beef, in fact, are given estrogenic hormones. Estrogens exert a carcinogenic influence on the body, and as a result, adding more estrogen to the diet, again, adds, in a small way, but cumulative way with all the other chemicals coming in, to the carcinogenic burden on the body. There are a number of safe cuts of meat, certainly. My eating habits have changed in the course of researching Diet for a Poisoned Planet. For example, I eat a lot more duck, which I have found from monitoring records is very low in contamination from pesticides. No hormones are given to the animal, very few antibiotics. I'll eat more duck, I eat more chicken. I try not to eat too much beef because of a number of reasons, including the fact that beef are given hormones and may have higher levels of some pesticides, carcinogenic pesticides. Again, this is an area where consumers have a right to control their exposure to toxic chemicals, but they're left in the dark by supermarkets and by the federal and state regulators. So Diet for a Poisoned Planet is filling a void and giving people information that they can use to make educated choices when they're in the supermarket.
One of the questions, what about dairy foods? Are there some dairy foods then we should be concerned about?
Sure. Again, the fattiest dairy foods tend to have the highest concentrations of pesticides. So if you want your child to have a great dessert in the evening, instead of giving them ice cream with a very high fat content, choose a non-fat frozen yogurt, for example. Put on a go to the health food store and get some Cascadian Farm strawberry, organic strawberry jam, very reasonably priced, and give them a very healthy dessert. You know, instead of putting on chocolate and hot, fatty ice cream. One of the things that I found very interesting is the fact that milk chocolate has very high levels compared with all other foods of two banned pesticides, benzene hexachloride and lindane. And again, it's something to be aware of. And if you can make a choice between, say, milk chocolate and a non-chocolate candy, certainly the non-chocolate candy has some advantages in reducing our exposure to pesticide residue. And getting back to dairy, it's not to say that children shouldn't have dairy foods, but again, those that are the fattiest will tend to have the most contamination and the most pesticide residue.
All right, so we've talked about the dairy foods. Now, I understand that even in wine and alcoholic beverages, we've got pesticides.
That's true. Fortunately, there's a revolution going on in California among the wine growers, and many are switching to organic methods. Already, you can go into a number of wine stores, and there are a number of places listed in the back of Diet for a Poison Planet that you can order from, too, and find great-tasting organic wines. And wines that are grown with chemicals tend to have neurotoxins like carbaryl and dimethylate in them almost invariably. As a result, the effect not only on the drinker is there, but on the workers who pick the grapes. And when you have organic wines without pesticides, you're not only doing something which is great for your own body, but you're really contributing to making the planet safer for the farmer, for the farm worker, and for wildlife. And organic wines taste great, and they can be purchased at many stores now. A couple of brands to look out for example, would be Frey, that's F-R-E-Y. And there are a number of French wines, and there's Four Chimney Farm in the Northeast, which produces excellent organic wines as well.
Now, should we be concerned about things like beer then?
Interestingly, beer these days is one of the safer alcoholic beverages. On the other hand, imported liqueurs and scotch and other liquors like that tend to have a chemical called urethane, which is a byproduct of the manufacturing process. A number of consumer groups have petitioned the Food and Drug Administration to set up much more strict standards so that manufacturers of alcoholic beverages would have to eliminate urethane contamination of their products, but the FDA has given the manufacturers a free rein and has not forced them to stop the manufacturing processes that produce this chemical, which does cause cancer. It's a very potent carcinogen. So there are some companies which are doing a good job, particularly the Canadian producers, because of Canada's stricter regulations in regard to urethane. The Diet for a Poison Planet lists over 100 different brands of liqueur and scotch and other alcoholic beverages and shows readers which ones have the least amount of urethane in them, again, so people can make informed choices.
Okay, now we've heard the bad news. For the rest of the show, let's talk about the good news. Namely, you found yourself to be highly toxic. You were able to detoxify yourself. The good news is that we can actually change what has happened to us, can't we?
Well, that is an important, it's important not to be brought down or to get depressed about the chemicals in our food. Rather, it's important to face the situation clearly and intelligently and make choices. I found that I did have quite a load of PCB and DDT in my body. And in fact, I had so much PCB that if I were a food, I'd have to be destroyed by the Food and Drug Administration. I couldn't cross state lines. But I found that by regulating my eating choices and just making informed choices, not...
I'm sorry, that made me laugh. Are most of us breaking the law by going from state to state?
You know, some people have so much PCB, and then that glow that you see when you meet somebody, maybe it may not be just happiness. It may be the toxic chemicals. People do build up these chemicals. They don't dissipate from the body very quickly, so we do tend to build them up if we make the wrong choices for foods. But by making informed choices and also by exercising and following up exercise with low-heat saunas, we can actually effectively purge our bodies of a number of toxic chemicals. Over the centuries, the sweat has been used by Native Americans, by the Cinnabar miners of Spain, by industrial workers to purge their bodies of chemicals. One of our most efficient pathways, for example, is our perspiration for getting rid of toxic chemicals. And we can enhance this by getting our blood circulating through all our tissues with, 30 minutes of good aerobic exercise, and then following up with a sauna of 140 to 160 degrees. And over a matter of months, our bodies will become much purer and freer from a number of toxic chemicals. I've actually had chemicals measured in my perspiration to verify this, and it works very well. There are a number of positive things which we can do for ourselves to help clear our minds, to help bring back energy to our bodies. And it all starts with facing the situation clearly, not throwing up our hands and just being totally defeated by the situation, but facing it clearly and with a very positive attitude, and by making informed choices based on always being educated and learning more about the foods that we're eating.
Now, how can the average person, though, without going to have blood tests and everything, is there a way that you can tell if there are dangerous chemicals in the body tissues?
Well, certainly if you're feeling lethargic and doctors haven't been able to diagnose why, certainly if you are having certain kinds of headaches, if you're not functioning well mentally, if you seem to have a depressed nervous system, you should have a workup done for chemicals, solvents, for example, that might be in drinking water, heavy pesticides, heavy residues of pesticides in the body. Usually insurance, if you are insured, will pay for these workups. If you feel fine, then all you need to do is just to keep making informed choices and make sure you don't eat one or two of the wrong foods. You know, that's what happens to a lot of people, unfortunately. They find one food that they really love. Maybe it's a white fish from the Great Lakes, for example, and they eat too much of it. And if that fish is contaminated, they begin to build up the PCBs in their body, and this does put a cancer burden on their body, as well as affecting the way that their clarity of mind and the way that they think and the speed with which they react to things. And again, making informed choices is a real key to maintaining health.
Now, you bring up a very interesting point in your book, and I believe it has to do with pet foods.
Oh, there's some wonderful news about pet food. First of all, Ralston Purina, in its Nature Course dog food, has chosen to use pesticide-free grains, which is just wonderful. That's such a progressive move by that company. They deserve credit for that. And again, that's because of the effect that we consumers are having on the marketplace by where we're spending our dollars. When you're buying pet foods, again, read the labels. Some pet foods do contain carcinogenic dyes and colorings, especially the little pet treats. And be careful. Don't expose your pets to carcinogenic chemicals. Along that line, also be careful of the pesticides, if you use any, that you use on your grass lawn. A study came out in which it was found that dogs developed a higher rate of cancer if lawns had been sprayed with the lawn herbicide 2,4-D. Your pets are very close to the ground, and they can absorb these chemicals, and you want to be careful in that regard as well.
Let's talk a little bit about the lawn industry. We've heard a lot about that these days. I realize that's not in Diet for a Poisoned Planet, but you must have some information on there that can help us.
I'm an avid gardener, and I'm always looking for ways to grow my vegetables and herbs without using any herbicides or pesticides. I don't use any. I should be very clear on that. Instead, I look for biological controls. I use lace wings and ladybugs in my garden. I use yellow sticky traps, and I use a lot of innovative techniques. For example, I have found that thyme makes a wonderful barrier against any snail, so I use thyme throughout my garden to protect young vegetables from snails instead of using snail bait, which is quite dangerous to cats and other pets. You can go into any nursery today and find excellent products like safer insecticidal soaps, which work very effectively and are non-toxic to the environment. You can order diatomaceous earth, which is another excellent product for use with snails and ants. And you can buy pyrethrins, which is a flower pesticide made from flowers, which also works very well against pests. So you can grow your own fruits and vegetables very well and not use pesticides. In fact, some of the fruits and vegetables, which are very expensive in the health food stores, like strawberries, I grow myself, so I don't need to spend the money in health food stores. I have my own organic strawberries straight from the garden.
All right, now, of course, people listening on the other different parts of the country aren't going to be able to do a lot of these things. However, I guess the point that you're making is that it is possible to grow crops on a small scale. What about a large scale without chemicals?
Well, farmers throughout the United States and Canada are now learning that they can grow their crops without pesticides. What they're doing is they'll switch 100 acres over to organic cultivation, that is, without pesticide use and synthetic fertilizer use. And once they feel that they've got these 100 acres under control, they switch more acreage over. And gradually it's increasing, and gradually we're finding that throughout the country, farming is going through a very quiet, incremental revolution where farmers are switching over to organic methods. They would in a second if they knew how to grow crops without pesticides, because the farmers themselves are concerned about their own health in being so closely in contact with herbicides and pesticides.
Now, it seems to me, David, that it would be cheaper to not have to use pesticides. Is that correct?
Well, sure, there's an overhead cost with pesticides that does factor in. And there are many hidden costs, that is, water pollution, illness, wildlife decimation, waste dumps that become contaminated from pesticides which are disposed of. There are all sorts of environmental costs which aren't factored into the cost of our crops. If we had to pay for all the environmental damage caused by the use of pesticides, our food would be much more expensive. The use of organic methods, on the other hand, cuts these costs. In addition, the organic farming is saving family farms throughout North America by helping farmers cut down costs and finding markets so that they can grow their crops and have enough margin to keep the farm going.
Okay, now why then now are organically grown foods so much more expensive?
Well, it's a simple case of supply and demand. There's a huge demand for organic foods, and there's still a small supply. Prices for organic foods are coming down, and they will continue to come down as more farmers become organic farmers. But for now, the supply is so much less than demand that farmers can get premium prices. By the way, there is no reason why organic foods should be cosmetically any less desirable than chemically grown foods. Organic farming is so sophisticated today that we should demand as consumers that organic foods be cosmetically as perfect looking as chemically grown foods. It's certainly well within the reach of organic farming.
Here's a couple questions. I don't know if these are addressed in your book, but I want to ask them. First, tell me a little bit about radiation. Why is that being used?
Well, food irradiation, the theory behind it is that you could keep a hamburger preserved for 6 or 7 years, you know, so you can keep fruits and vegetables on the shelves for many more weeks with food irradiation. and that cuts down shrinkage for the packer and the producer. On the other hand, food irradiation tends to destroy the nutrient content of food. So you may have a perfect-looking strawberry that's been on the shelf for 2 or 3 weeks, but the amount of vitamin C in that strawberry will be greatly diminished because of the irradiation process. Irradiation is a process by which foods are exposed to gamma radiation, and that tends to kill off some of the bacteria and fungus that might cause food to deteriorate more quickly. But on the other hand, it does destroy nutrients. It's a process that also brings radioactive materials into communities, and it doesn't really serve an interest for the consumer. It does serve an interest for some food manufacturers, and it serves the interests of the nuclear industry by continuing the use of radioactive material. Also in regard to radiation, and this is very timely because of the most recent Soviet nuclear accident, a lot of apple juice sold in supermarkets throughout the United States comes from countries in Europe such as Hungary and Germany and Austria, the concentrate. And this concentrate is radioactive because of radiation leaks from Chernobyl primarily. So when you're buying apple juice in the supermarket, be sure to buy an apple juice made with apples from North America. You'll be sure not to be growing later when you drink the apple juice.
So one of the important points here that you're making is that consumers have within their power the ability to change the industry.
We are changing the industry, and it's so exciting. You know, mainstream supermarkets today are stocking organic carrots, organic potatoes, and lettuce, and that's because consumers are saying we want food that is healthy for our bodies and healthy for the environment. We are making change. We're doing it ourselves, and it's exciting to see that we are having this tremendous effect on the way our food is produced.
The book, Diet for a Poisoned Planet. We have a few more minutes, and I think that I'd like to find out about some other possibilities. What can we do in other areas of our life to make our lives safer from toxic chemicals?
Well, certainly the cosmetics that you use on your body are an important. It's important to be aware of the number of carcinogens in cosmetics. I'm researching cosmetics now for my next book, and I've found that you can buy very pure products, like Aubrey Organics produces wonderful products. But many of the cosmetic products that are advertised as natural, in fact, contain a number of dyes and colorings and other carcinogenic chemicals to be aware of. And so be aware of your personal care items and cosmetics. Do things in your home to clean up your home environment. For example, drinking water is an important it's very important to have pure drinking water, and a simple home filter that may cost $100 to $200 can radically clean up your drinking water from the products of chlorination, which are necessary to kill bacteria, but at the end point are not needed and, in fact, can cause cancer in humans. So clean up your drinking water. When you garden, do it without pesticides. Read books on biological pest control and other non-toxic methods of gardening, and clean up your environment there. If you have babies, be aware now that there are many, many organic baby foods on the market, and the even one of the major producers, Gerber, is producing an organic baby food now. So look for these products for your babies and infants, because, again, it's a way of cleaning up our bodies and living a lifestyle which is much more conducive to a healthy planet.
All right, for our listeners, I'm holding the book. It's a soft cover now. It's a Ballantine book, Diet for a Poisoned Planet, How to Choose Safe Foods for You and Your Family. It's available everywhere in the United States and in Canada. David, if people wanted to get in touch with you, can they write to you?
Well, they can ask me any questions they'd like and write to me, care of Ballantine Books, New York, New York. And I get all the mail, and I love hearing from readers and hearing their comments, and I find it very interesting and helpful to hear what people have as their concerns.
All right, and one last thing. So your book has divided up all these into three categories: red food, red light foods, green light foods, and yellow light foods. We can follow your book. Now we have to go into an ordinary supermarket. Are the foods easy to find this way?
Well, that's the whole point of Diet for a Poison Planet, to let you go into any supermarket and know which foods are the safest and which foods are the most dangerous in terms of their chemical contamination. Armed with Diet for a Poison Planet, you can be an informed shopper and make educated choices in any supermarket, wherever you are in the United States and Canada.
I look forward to talking to you real soon. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
This is Bruce Stephen Holmes. I hope that your own personal voyage through life towards the development of your highest potential is a joyous and successful one.